Welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're streaming live at kuci.org. I'm your host, Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest today is Jodi Forrester. She's had essays and short stories in the Sonora Review, Two Hawks Quarterly, Write Room, Dreamers Writing, Citroen Review, Gazelle, and several others. A story received an honorable mention in the Anderbo Open City Competition in 2009, and another story was featured in the 6th Annual Emerging Voices Group Show in LA in 2010. She is an MFA from Bennington College, lives in Venice, California, with her husband, John, by the beach. And she's here today to primarily talk about Guns Under the Bed, Memories of a Young Revolutionary, published by Odyssey Books. Hi, Jodi.
Hi, Barbara.
Hi, great to have you.
Oh, thanks so much. I really appreciate your bringing me here.
Oh, of course. Let's begin, as we always do, with you introducing the book and talking about how it came to be.
Sure. The book, again, Guns Under the Bed, Memories of a Young Revolutionary, delves into a time of my life when I was just a freshman in college at San Jose State University. And I already, having been an anti-war protester in high school, the first thing I did when I went to college was look for like-minded people. And there was a rally that was going on, and a representative of the Revolutionary Union, which was a Maoist organization, he was talking, and he seemed to have answers that I had not heard of before. That rather than we could do this, we could do that, we could do this, we could do that, it was like very single-minded, we can do this. We need to foment a revolution against the ruling class. And drawn to that, I began to talk to him, and I ended up joining the organization and staying there for 3.5 years. As it turned out, when I left under difficult circumstances and moved to Vancouver, British Columbia, and put that time of my life behind me. But there was always a recurrent dream or even a nightmare from one particular time that continued to haunt me over the years. And it just got to the point where I needed to understand what took me there. What, out of all the millions marching against the war, how did I get onto such a singular path to join such a very far left and radical organization?
Okay, so let's back up a bit. So you're trained as a chiropractor.
Yes.
And worked as a chiropractor for years. And how did you find your way to writing?
I had always wanted to write and had always written, you know, stories here, stories there, but never felt satisfied with them. It didn't even occur to me to do anything with them. For 25 years, I practiced as a chiropractor. I was married, I am married, and had two children. The raising of them took pretty much all of my attention. But then a wrist injury forced me to quit. And not knowing quite what to do next, but knowing I had to do something, I remembered and recalled that I had always wanted to write, and I started taking classes a little bit here, a little bit there, and eventually going to Bennington for my MFA, and that put me on a whole different path.
So when you were in Bennington, were you into the memoir? Were you thinking of memoir? Or were you thinking of fiction? Or what were you doing? What were you focusing on?
Pretty much all fiction. And I had always been a big short story fan. I mean, I truly love short fiction, and that's what I wanted to do, and that's what I studied. What happened with this piece is that I kept trying to write it as a short story, and it wasn't working because you really can't write good fiction if you already know how it's going to end. And after a couple of years of attempting that, I finally admitted that I was writing a memoir, and that brought me over to that nonfiction.
Yeah, because I was going to ask you, you know, how did you decide to do a memoir instead of a novel based on your past? But like you said, you knew how it was going to end. And so for you, what was the point, right? I mean, I know fiction writers work all sorts of ways, but that's really interesting. You know, like, I think basing fiction on real life can be really difficult too, because of, you know, as you say, you know how it's going to end, you know how it goes, and then what do you fictionalize, right?
Right. It's really problematical. And I resisted being a memoirist for a long time because I just wasn't ready to delve as deeply as I would need to if it were truly nonfiction. But it got to the point where I just had to acknowledge that. And I was in a really amazing workshop with Samantha Dunn. And she was the first one who said, Jody, come on, this is memoir and this is a book.
Well, it'd be a great time to hear you read from Guns Under the Bed. Could you do that?
Sure, I'm gonna read the prologue.
All right.
Actually repeat some of the things I just said about how, but that's what I'm going to do.
Okay.
On a morning in 2010, I went into the garage, determined to get rid of the old to make room for the new. Dozens of boxes, some unopened since our move in 1985, leaned against each other in precarious piles. Green garbage bags of our now adult daughter's stuffed animals, board games missing pieces, drawers full of the wooden handle tools inherited from my father. All of it could go. I tugged first on the plastic handle of a one-wheeled suitcase with a broken zipper, but something caught. Pulling harder, a large carton lying against it tipped over. Labeled, "Are you Steph?" it had traveled with me from San Jose to Vancouver, BC, to Los Angeles, stored always somewhere out of sight. The bent and frayed box contained over 3 years of my late adolescence, chronicling the only period of my history that remained unexamined in a much examined life. When it hit the ground, out tumbled magazines, newspapers, and documents had accumulated from 1969 to 1972 while a member of the Communist Revolutionary Union. Sitting on the paint-stained cement floor, I thumbed through proclamations and calls for political action, as well as national and international newsletters from those times. Minutes from RU meetings, internal memos, leaflets for demonstrations and marches, I hadn't realized that I'd kept so much. There in the pile was a much thumbed, underlined, and highlighted little red book with Mao Zedong's many quotations of how to put theory into practice. Two photographs fell face up on the garage floor, one taken while I sat at the Revolutionary Union information table erected daily outside the student union at San Jose State University. I'm wearing a navy blue Mao cap replete with red star, my downward gaze pensive, quiet, wary of the camera. Maybe 18, to me now I look impossibly young. The other picture was a Polaroid of a group of us marching on the sidewalk, me in front blowing a kazoo, holding a sign that said, ROT must go. My middle finger pointed defiantly up. I'm wearing my favorite poncho, red with a Navajo pattern crossing the middle, a handkerchief holding back my unruly hair. Again, I look so young, however old I felt at the time. Evidence reminded me of those years when I slept with a .30-06 and an M1 rifle under my bed. So many in my generation protested the unjust war in Vietnam and marched for civil rights. How was it that I was one of only a few hundred who went on to join an organization with the most extreme of ideologies? How was it that I was so willing to put my life on the line, a life I had yet to value? Youthful conviction born of the zeitgeist of the time, or something missing in myself that I sought to remedy? While it's true that much of the baby boomer generation felt displaced and alienated by the establishment mentality, why me? I decided it was time to reclaim those lost years, to learn more about how I got there and how I got from there to here. Ready finally to release the stories the box held, I loaded it back up and took it into my office to begin the work.
Thank you so much. That was Jody Forrester reading Guns Under the Bed, Memories of a Young Revolutionary, published by Odyssey. I love that prologue, and It really grabbed me. I loved the voice and the tone of it. And then you go from that to a pretty gripping first chapter. How did you decide to begin with that chapter for the first chapter following the prologue?
Well, this event was a night that my group, my collective, went into my living room, all of us armed, because we thought that the police were about to raid. And, sorry about that. And that's the scene that kept recurring in my nightmares, because the question was, they didn't come in, but had they? I undid my safety. I had my finger on the trigger, and at the last moment, we called a halt. But would I have pulled the trigger? And that is that was the underlying, in my nightmares, I went so many places with that.
Yeah, it was gripping.
After, because it really did set the tone for what I experienced. Excuse me for interrupting.
No, that's all right. Yeah, and then the structure was interesting, because you kind of, after that, you go back to a really young age, and it worked. I mean, I liked how you brought in backstory, how backstory kept coming in throughout the book and at key times. And so I started thinking about the structure and how much you knew going in. Did you I don't know, outline it or you know, plot it or you know, do anything for yourself to know how it was all going to go?
The only thing that I did do, and it wasn't until I was quite a bit, quite a way into the memoir, is I had a paper where I had the dates written out, because I was sort of going a little willy-nilly at first and putting things in from 1972, following 1962, going back to 1952. But otherwise, no, I didn't have an outline. I have to say, I initially wrote it as a series of individual essays, each experience. And again, under Samantha Dunn's tutelage, when she said, you've got a book, not essays, that's when I began to thread them together into a single document.
These days, I always think about themes. And so as I was reading and after I was through with the book, I was thinking about the themes in your memoir, because as well as it being a story about the group and joining up with them and what happened, it's also about you finding your way. And did you think about themes as you're writing, or I mean, this is something we always talk about on this show. Is it up to the writer to think about themes and to write along those lines, or are themes what readers bring to a book?
I was at a loss when that question was brought up first. What are your themes? Because I didn't know. It wasn't until I had finished the book and got to like the second or third draft that those began to emerge. So I don't know the answer, really. Is it something that the reader brings to it? Is it something that the writers do consciously? Because I really didn't explore them consciously. Not for, like I said, till about the third draft. And then I realized that that I was actually operating on certain themes.
Did you, what I want to say is, I love how you brought in your own life, and you do what memoirists need to do, which is to put yourself on the page, flaws and all. And so did you think about that as you were writing? I mean, I think a mistake we see maybe new memoirists or essayists doing is making themselves look too good, which then of course collapses any empathy that a reader might have, because if this narrator is so wonderful, then why am I reading this book? but you have a nice balance here. And I wonder what sort of attention you paid to that, if any.
Well, again, I was really just writing, and I was trying to figure out or look at what early experiences and who I was temperamentally that shaped me, that essentially drew me into an organization that was so radical. And it was not difficult for me to retrieve my early, you know, my earliest memories. There were more than a few fairly traumatic experiences that made me feel outside of my family, outside of the people, my neighbors. And I wasn't really thinking, I didn't really have any concern about what I was feeling. I'm kind of at a certain age now that I don't feel like I have anything to hide. And it was really not particularly important to me.
Well, are you naturally introspective? Because I ask that because, again, there's such a nice balance between the action of the book and sort of your interior as the narrator. And this is something else I think memoirs have a really difficult time balancing is getting the action on the page, getting the story moving, and including enough reflection or enough interior so that we are with the narrator and we care about what happens. Talk about that, because, you know, I don't know if it's just a natural way you have of expressing yourself, or if you had to work at kind of getting yourself on the page and how you felt and what you thought about what was going on.
Organically, I am very introspective to the point where I really had to rein myself in over the years, because there is a very thin line between introspection and narcissism. I didn't really want, there were times, well, I have journals that I've kept pretty much since I was about, I don't know, I started when I was in single digits. And almost all the pages, there's next to nothing about the environment that I'm in. It's all about me being unhappy, or me being this felt good, or I like that guy. And I went through looking at them, seeing if I could find some kind of insight to myself. But in fact, I found very little, because it was all me, 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 me. And so when I was writing, not very much, but there were pages that I just had gone too far. And I had a sense of balance just intuitively. So I was able to keep that under control.
Did you find that because maybe your strength is that interior, writing that interior and getting that voice on the page, that you had to work harder to write complete scenes?
No, I didn't really have to work harder, but you know, I already, from coming from writing short fiction, I was already, I already had that experience. So I was drawing a lot of my fiction education to the memoir.
You know, I love that, because it seems the only difference sometimes between memoir and fiction is that memoir happened. Or hopefully happened, because you use a lot of the same chops, right? I mean, you use just so much of what you use in writing fiction when you're writing memoir.
The difficulty, the biggest difficulty that I had with writing fiction was that old, you know, trope, show don't tell, because I'm a teller. I could sit there and tell you a story without really creating any kind of scene with it. But my husband's the opposite. He is very much somebody who expresses himself in scene. And so I've learned a lot from him. And that was something that I always kept in mind when I was writing, was not to, and honestly, I did so many revisions on this. I mean, so many dozens and dozens of drafts. And most of the thing that I had to clean up was the telling versus the scene.
When you say you did so many drafts, talk a little bit more about that. I mean, like when you would do a draft, would you consider a draft tweaking words or just completely rewriting scenes and adding scenes, deleting scenes? I mean, talk about just the whole revision process that you went through for this book.
There was adding scenes, there were deleting scenes, but almost all of them, there was tweaking. It was all tweaking. I didn't like this sentence. I didn't like where that period was. I needed, you know, four words more, four words less. So when I say drafts, I know it's a bit of a misnomer because it was, they're not complete drafts. I hear people writing books and they have three drafts and I think, wow, I had like, you know, more than 30.
Do you read aloud?
I do. It's hard. I mean, here I am on a radio show and I'm admitting that my voice, it's, it's easy for me to have a monotonal voice. But I do read aloud. I do indeed. I read the whole book aloud at least two times. And then several times I would read chapters here and chapters there.
Hmm. I think hearing your own voice is difficult for a lot of people. I mean, you know, we don't sound as we think we do, right? When we're talking, it's like, it's not the same thing at all.
Yeah. Yeah.
You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Jody Forrester. Her book is Guns Under the Bed, Memories of a Young Revolutionary, published by Odyssey. I like the size of the memoir. I read it in a day or two, and it just really moved along, which was just so nice to be in your world, the world back then, for a couple of days. Do you recall how many manuscript pages it was?
Manuscript pages, it was about, 260. Mm-hmm. You know, I've got a helicopter circling over my house. I hope that's not a problem.
No, I can't hear it.
I live in Venice. What can I say?
So maybe around 55,000 words, something like that?
You got it. Well, probably about 59,000 words. Yes.
Yeah, good. It's a good size. I don't know. I like being able to read a book, a memoir, especially in a couple of days, so I can stay in the world. And there's so much to read, right? I mean, it's just nice when you get a hold of a book that just grabs you, you stay with it. And, you know, I couldn't find scenes or pages I would have deleted, which I seem to always be doing when I'm reading big books. It's like, what can I get rid of here? Where was the editor? And I didn't think that reading this. So thank you.
You're welcome. I was really concerned about it being relatively short, but what I was reading is that the average memoir is 60,000 to 90,000 words, and I didn't have anything more to write, so that's how it ended up that way. Anything that I added would have been pretty superfluous.
Well, don't you find, I don't know, I find all the time with bigger books that sometimes I feel like the reason they're bigger is because either the editor wanted the writer to write more so it would be a bigger book, or the writer couldn't figure out what to cut and the editor was no help. I mean, it's just...
No, I know. I've had that experience too, where I've just thought, where was the editor?
Yeah, where was the editor? Well, the ending is so moving, and it created a really nice sort of spirally link back to the prologue. And I was just talking about this yesterday with the novelist John Boyne, that while the entire book is, of course, important, the entire book has to be good. It's that last chapter that is really important in that it makes the reader want to read your next book or not. And your last chapter and the last, I have it marked here even, the last couple of paragraphs were just so moving. And I'm curious about that chapter, if it came easy for you or I guess it's the epilogue I'm talking about. Talk about wrapping it up. And, was this always the ending? And talk about that.
I came across the ending when I was at the ending. I'm sort of searching for the words. My first ending was a lot of a recap of what had already been said. And at some point I realized that like the first three or four paragraphs were just like saying again what had already been said. So once I cut that out, it came pretty organically. You know, I was sort of aware of what strings were still dangling and I wanted to tie them up.
Mm. What was the hardest aspect of writing the book?
The hardest, I'm so sorry about all the external noise. The hardest is paying attention, is really keeping while I'm keeping the larger picture in mind, as I'm writing, it's really critical to telescope in, not only to my memories, but my feelings, and then back up and get the wide angle to make sure everything is integrated. And structurally, I think the real problem that I had was structure. It was I wrote so many of the chapters were in different orders for so long until I finally realized that, well, the obvious answer is to write linearly.
Hmm. Yeah, that it can be a problem, I suppose, when you write standalone pieces, right? And then they become part of a book. And then it's figuring out where everything goes, right?
Right. And structure at the best of times is something that I have struggled with, both in my short fiction and even in my essays.
Structure's hard. I think structure's really difficult too.
Yeah, well, writing's hard.
Well, talk about selling the book and finding a publisher, the publisher in Australia.
That was serendipity, and I'm truly grateful to the publisher. Her name is Michelle Lovey, and I tried first very hard to find an agent. I sent out the book to more than 60 agents who I had read on Publishers Weekly that were taking memoirs, and those that answered, and not all of them answered, of course, basically said, I really like the writing. It's just not in my experience. I don't know how to sell it. Mm-hmm. And then I started sending to three, four dozen independent publishers. And I got a lot of the same feedback. We really like it, but we don't really know what to do. We don't know how to market it. And the one person who responded positively was Odyssey Books. So there it was that they became my publisher and I'm really happy that it worked out that way. There are problems with having them, so far away. We have experienced some difficulty in communication, but when all was said and done, I'm really happy with how they've done the book.
Yeah. And I love the photo on the front, the cover.
I love the cover. That was that I had found when I was going through the garage. And it was, it just made me laugh because, there I am. I've got my finger up. I'm blowing on a kazoo. The person next to me is, holding a penny whistle. The person next to him is beating on a drum. I mean, we look like such students.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great cover.
Thank you.
Before we go, I wonder if you have any last words or tips for memoirists who are listening.
Well, I think the thing that many memoirs that I speak of have difficulty with is get, you know, is they're trying to edit as they go along. And then, you know, which can push you into despair because you're not really paying attention to the process that's unfolding. I just say, go for it, get it all down on the paper, and then you can edit it down. I'm huge on revision. I, you know, there's the proverbial, can't say that on the radio, I'm so sorry. You know, the proverbial terrible first draft. And I would say to any memoirist, just be patient with yourself. You know, the only way to get there is to keep sitting down and to know that eventually there's tools in your writing toolbox that can, will help you honing it into a story that tells everything without having to sabotage yourself right from the start.
Yeah. That's so true. Get it down.
Yeah, just get it down.
Jody, thank you so much for taking the time. It's been a pleasure.
I feel the same way, Barbara. I truly appreciate your giving my book this attention. I appreciate our being able to have this conversation on KUCI, and I thank you.
Yes, thank you. The book again is Guns Under the Bed, Memories of a Young Revolutionary by Jody A. Forrester, published by Odyssey. My guest is Lucy Bridge. Lucy has written for Catapult, Story, Brooklyn, Split Lip Magazine, and The Sun, and her writing has been nominated for a Pushcart Prize. Sad Janet is her first novel and was named one of the best books of the summer by Lit Hub, The Millions, and Refinery 29. And a past guest, Cynthia Dupree Sweeney, author of The Nest, she was on a few years ago, she blurbed the book and said, a biting, pitch-perfect novel about one woman's desire to stay true to herself, hilarious, wise, wicked, and tender. Welcome to the show, Lucy.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Let's begin with you introducing the novel and talking about its genesis.
Oh, I don't know where to start. That's a big question.
Where to come, how to come about?
I've been writing it for a few years. It was, I don't know how to answer that. Oh dear, this is a bad start already.
Well, because I was thinking as I was walking this morning, I was thinking that one of the themes of the novel is that it's an indictment of the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah.
That pills can and should stop us from feeling sad. Why not take a pill and be happy? And Janet succumbs to the pressure and takes the Christmas pills so she'll be happy or at least be able to tolerate Christmas. So
yeah.
That seemed to be one of the main themes for me. I mean, there's so many sub-themes going on here, as with any book, I think. But talk about that.
Yeah, there's the idea of Big Pharma and how feelings are sort of monetized now more. And I don't really agree with that. I'm obviously clinical depression, something else that might need the pill, but I can see it going another way. Like it becoming more like this idea of a Christmas pill sort of just came to me a few years ago because Christmas is such a huge big deal, and I suppose I wasn't feeling very Christmassy at the time, and I thought, oh, maybe if there was a pill then I would take it just for a short time. So that's sort of how it came about, really, I suppose, like my own desire for this pill didn't exist.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you just said you were working on it for a few years, but how many years was that?
Maybe about 4 years ago I started writing it, and then only just about a year and a half ago I really felt like I could do it, so then I finished it.
So during that time, because I know you've had shorter pieces published, would you put it away and work on a story or an essay?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, I hadn't even really finished a short story a few years ago. I just didn't really feel capable. And then once I'd finished a short story and had that published, I think it gave me a sort of a confidence that I could maybe finish a whole novel.
You know, then, you know, this inspires a whole other line of thought for me, which is, how did you come to writing?
I always wanted to be a writer. It was always the only thing I ever wanted to do, but I just don't think I ever really believed I could. I mean, I always loved books and I always wanted to work with books, but I just didn't think it was something I could do. I don't know. I just didn't really believe in myself. I didn't go to writing school. I did English and culture at university, but I just didn't really ever believe in myself until more recently.
Well, when the idea started crystallizing, did you do any sort of outline or plotting, or did you just jump into it, or did you write a story first, or how did you know? Maybe talk a little bit about actually the process of getting the story on the page.
I'm not really a big planner. I don't really have a process. I always feel like I'm probably doing it wrong, but I always think as long as I get there in the end, it doesn't matter really. But I had the basic idea for the novel, but it just sort of, I don't know, I write quite sort of lucidly and then I go with it, and then I sort of piece it together at the end. I work very strangely compared to other writers, I think.
No, I think a lot of writers, especially new writers, think that they need to have a plot or an outline before they can get going. And so many writers are kind of seat of the pants, kind of, let's see where this takes me, you know, with the process.
I'm definitely not like that. For me, writing is a really organic thing. I can only really write when I feel it. I can't really force it. So to have a plan, it doesn't feel creative to me. I know other people can't work without them, but for me, it sort of stifles me a bit. I'm getting a bit better at it now as I get more used to it. Now I'm writing other things. It's useful, but I don't really ever stick to it.
So the voice of Janet, it's such a quirky voice. And did you have to work at finding that voice, or is that your writing voice? Is that what comes out when you work on stories or whatever you write?
Yeah, I think it's a sort of heightened version of myself in a way. Mm-hmm. She's not me, obviously, but there are parts of her that are me. So I sort of find that I found the sad Janet in me, really, and brought it out. But she's not me.
Yeah. And the first person present tense as well, you know, it's happens to be one that I like very much, because you as the reader are in the character shoes. I mean, there's no real distance. And
I always really write like that. It's just what comes naturally, I think. I don't know. If I try to write any other way, it doesn't really feel right. I always want my characters, so I sort of have to be them as well, if that makes sense.
Yeah, because, you know, it's interesting. I mean, usually writers in the first person tend to do past tense. And I love present tense.
I think we felt like it was sort of, we needed the emergency, that's what I think of the word now, sort of the urgency of it, because it was better sort of now. It worked the character more to be that in the present tense.
Yeah, interesting. I love the epigraph, which really is the entryway into the book, which is by John Waters. And he says, if you just broke up with someone, be sad. If you just ran over somebody drunk driving, feel depressed. You shouldn't take a pill that makes you feel okay about terrible things. Did you have that epigraph as you were writing, or did you find it later?
Oh yeah, I'm a huge John Waters fan. I've loved him all my life. He's just brilliant. But I read that a few years ago in an interview he did, and I had it stuck on my pin board. And it was just, but I'd already started writing Sad Janet before that, but it sort of fitted with the book. So it sort of guided me through it.
Yeah, I love epigraphs. They always, you know, they tell you so much about what's to come. I have to read you one more thing from your book, which is close to the beginning. And it's, you know, so much of this book is funny and true. And this is, might be in the first chapter, second chapter. Anyway, the character says, my mother was overcompensating for something, everything maybe, like everyone else. That was all the holidays were about, filling the void. As a result, Christmas at our house was brutal, like someone sitting on your chest and punching you in the face repeatedly, but in an ugly snowflake sweater and to the sounds of Dolly Parton singing Jingle Bells. That just made me laugh. I just had to laugh out loud at that. And there's so many.
That sums up Christmas for me.
So when you're writing, are you actually seeing if what you're writing feels funny to you? Or do you read it aloud? How does that go?
Yeah, well, definitely. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's definitely what's funny to me, and I hope other people find it funny too. But if I write something and it makes me laugh out loud, then I think, oh, maybe that's good, and then hopefully someone else will find it funny. Mm. They might not. Sometimes someone might come back and say, oh, I don't get this, but might quite often they do.
Do you have readers? Do you run your stuff by anybody before you?
I don't. I'm very, very. The only person who reads anything I write is my agent, Stacey. I keep things very close to my chest.
Has it always been that way?
Yeah. I have shown things to my sister sometimes, but I generally don't let anyone read anything I write ever.
So before you got your agent, I mean, so you weren't in a writer's group, you were writing on your own?
Yeah, I've never taken a writing class or been part of a group, I've only ever written on my own. It was always quite a private thing, and I only really shared it with the world, you know, in the last few years.
So where did you get the confidence then to find an agent?
My agent found me.
Oh, so through one of the publications?
Yeah, I was looking for an agent at the time, but she approached me she read one of my stories in The Sun, and she said she just really loved it, and then we clicked, and it was meant to be.
You know, that's great when it happens that way. I do hear of it happening that way, and that has to be the best.
It was lovely. I mean, I was looking for an agent at the time, but it was just fate.
No, I love that. I think it's been said before, but your work in a way is reminiscent of Tessa Moshfegh's work, but your character Janet is lighter somehow. She's funny, or maybe you have a lighter touch. You're just funnier than Tessa. I don't know. But is she someone that you have read or admired, and what do you think about that, being compared in any way to her?
I always do get compared to her, and that's I'm very flattered. She's brilliant, obviously, and I do like her writing, but I'm not really the same as her. I think we write about the same things, but I don't really think my style is like her at all. I think she's possibly much darker than I am. Like you said,
yeah, your stuff is so light. It's, you know, it, I wouldn't call it, I know some, one of the reviews I read said darkly comic, something like that. And that kind of fit, but I wouldn't call it humor either. You know, I don't know. I think it's just quirky to me. It's literary fiction with a quirky cast or something. Yeah. But so was the beginning always the beginning? We have Janet, she's in the bathroom, and she is, I think, at work. She's at work at the shelter where she works. Has that always been the beginning?
Not necessarily exactly the beginning, because, I won't spoil it, but it starts with her in the bathroom. But that came later. Really, but it always started with her at the shelter as like an in life.
Yeah, so then, you know, take us through a little bit of the process of this then. I mean, do you barrel through, or do you, you know, have to get a paragraph exactly perfect before you go on to the next?
No, not at all. I write really fast. I write a lot of rubbish really fast, and then I go back and edit really slowly. I sort of have to get it out, and I write in really random bits, and it's madness. I always say it's, my writing is just madness. I don't really know how it comes together at the end, but it does somehow.
So when you say really fast, do you mean that you might write, you might have written this draft in 6 months and then spend, you know, 4 years revising, or how? Break it down.
Less than that even, really. I mean, I can write a really large chunk, like 10 pages in a day, and then spend about a week making it make sense and making it better.
And then go on and then continue chronologically with the story?
No, I don't work chronologically at all either. I've since Sad Janet, I've written two other books, and one I actually did write chronologically, and it's the first thing I've ever written properly from with like a beginning, middle and end. But generally I write like random bits and then I sort of place them like almost like a jigsaw. So I'm very strange.
No, I think that's actually encouraging, because I have a few students who work like that, and they feel as you do that they're doing it all wrong. But I think, you know, we all find our way, right? I mean, we all have a different process.
I always think I'm doing it wrong, but as long as at the end it's a book, I don't really mind.
Well, obviously you didn't do it wrong with this one, because it's in my hand. It's a beautiful hardcover book. If you just tuned in, you are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Lucy Bridge. Her book is Sad Janet, published by Riverhead Books. Has a beautiful image of, I think it's a miniature greyhound wearing a sweater on the front. How did that cover come about? Do you know?
Yeah, well, the first cover they sent me, it didn't really feel right. It was fine, but it wasn't amazing. And so I asked them to go see what else they could come up with. And they sent me this, and it just felt perfect. They didn't know, but I used to have rescue greyhounds, and one of them was the colour of the dog on the book, and it felt like fate again. It was just perfect. It made me really happy when I saw it, and I just thought, yeah, this is the cover.
Isn't that odd, you know, that they used to rescue greyhounds and they chose a greyhound? I think that is so interesting.
Yeah,
it's a beautiful cover. And it reminded me of a greyhound a friend of mine has. So when you started out, when you started sending your stories out, did you deal with rejection at all, or was your stuff just picked up immediately?
No, a lot of rejection. I still get rejection. It's, as they always tell you, it's part of it. But I did have a lot of rejection. And then the first thing, I can't remember what the first thing I had was, but it was just something small. But it was, you know, that gave me enough confidence to keep going, I suppose.
You know, rejection is one of those things. I mean, it means you're in the game, but it's also, I don't know if it ever gets easier to deal with. Mm-hmm. I think maybe if you get used to it and you realize that, you know, it can really decimate, I think, a writer's self-confidence, don't you think?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, someone told me that it's hard, even if you've written novels, it's still hard to get short stories published. And I think that's definitely true. It seems to be anyway.
And what about social media? Are you doing anything on Twitter, Facebook, or anywhere?
I am on Twitter, but I not very much. I just sort of keep my toe in. I tend to try and stay away from social media.
Does your publisher want you to be more involved? What are publishers saying these days?
I'm sure they would like me to be more involved, but they don't really push it. They know that I'm not really sort of sociable, so it's fine. I'm on Twitter and I'm there, so I'm not completely, you know, in the woods, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if you've spent much time in the U.S. Or with the U.S., you know, literary community. I'm so curious how you find it in terms of what it's like in where you live, you know, what the community, literary community is like in England. And I don't know.
I haven't ever really been part of anything here. Most of my friends who are writers are all in America, and most of the things nearly all the things I've ever had published are in American literary magazines. I've just never really been part of anything here because I always kept my writing to myself, really, and I don't live in a big city or anything. I've just never really been a part of any community like that.
Are there a lot of literary magazines there that, you know, that are would be right for your work, or
maybe not. I think because most of my peers are sort of in America, I've just always gravitated towards you. Mm-hmm. I don't know. There are literary magazines here, obviously, but I never really felt like they were right for my sort of writing.
So, okay, back to the book. I wanted to ask you about the shelter where Janet works and why you chose that job for her.
Well, I had that job when I left university. I worked at a shelter for a few years, so I suppose I'm just writing what I know in that classic way.
And then Melissa is her boss, and her boss has a few problems of her own, has children. Talk about secondary characters. And Melissa is a good one. She's there from the start, from the first page.
I don't know what to say. Obviously.
Was she based on anybody? Was she
no,
a composite?
No one in it is really based on anybody.
She was kind of a, you know, a straight man, you know.
Yeah.
It's like Janet is
Janet doesn't really get on with her family, then she has to sort of have her own, she's got her own other family at the shelter that she works with. She likes dogs better than people, but I suppose she's got this like other weird people that work at the shelter who are also a bit not good with people, I suppose. Mm-hmm.
You do interior really well, and I think like one of the strengths of this novel is that it's visual and sensory, and there's so many scenes, so that I always think, you know, the way to keep readers interested is to write in scenes so that, you know, we can see what's going on, and you do that, but you also give us quite a bit on the character's internal life. And I wonder if you could talk to that. I mean, do you see that as one of your strengths as a writer?
I don't think I really have any strength as a writer, really. I'm not really good at seeing any good qualities in anything I do, but I'm a bit self-deprecating to keep getting told off for. But when I write, quite often I'm thinking of it almost like a film. So in terms of scenes in a film, I watch a lot of them, and I would like to write one day. So I'm sort of always visualizing it. And I think that's where that comes from.
You know, there's so much that I think writers can learn from watching film, actually. I don't think TV does the same, even all the wonderful programming that's on, but films, you know, because novels and films are both, you know, basically dramatic writing, right?
Yeah,
and
exactly, so definitely.
There's so much you can learn from watching film.
Definitely, yeah. Yeah, I agree. Yes.
What about, we have a few minutes left. I wonder if you can talk about getting out of your own way. Like, do you ever hit blocks or hit walls and you don't know where
all
to go?
Time. Yeah, all the time.
What do you do?
I'm usually always writing more than one thing at once. So I'm a bit strange. So I always can, like, if something's not working, I can go and do something else. So that helps. But I also know that if something isn't working, I can just come away completely and maybe just have a day off writing. I think there's so much pressure on us to feel like we need to write every day. And sometimes we just need a day off, really.
You know, I don't think it's strange at all to have more than one thing going. I mean, I think that, you know, you go where the heat is. And if you're working on your book or story and it's not happening, then yeah, go somewhere else. Exactly. I think I know writers who actually even have projects in different rooms so that the story isn't working. Well, these are people that live sort of in the country that have big houses, right? You know,
my house is tiny. I don't have room for that.
Yeah. But it, you know, it's like, instead of just kind of battling your way through, just give it a break.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think writers are far too hard on themselves. Really, I think if something isn't working, it doesn't necessarily mean it's something you're doing wrong. It just maybe means you need some time out from it and some sort of different perspective.
Yeah, I agree. What about before we go? I wanted to ask you about letting it chill. I mean, do you, like, after you write something, will you put it away for a while and just, you know, give it a week, a month, a year, I don't know, until it feels unfamiliar before you pick it up and read it? Or do you just keep going with it? And
Now I keep going with it until it's done. And I don't really sleep until it's done. And then I will probably send it to my agent. He will tell me her honest opinion, and then I'll go away and have to fix it. But short stories, I definitely can put away for a long time and then come back to them, if you know, until I think they're right.
In terms of your agent, will your agent edit and really get involved with the work?
She's brilliant. Yeah, we're sort of a creative team. She gets really involved, and she's the only person I'd really let read anything, and whose opinion I trust at the early stages. So yeah,
that's exciting. It's great to have an agent like that.
She is very brilliant.
We are approaching the end of our time. I wonder if you have a great question. Nobody likes this question, but if you have any advice for the new writers listening who are working their way through a book or stories or whatever.
Yeah. I don't really agree with giving anyone writing advice, because I believe you sort of find your own way there. But I think you just ignore all the advice and do what you think's right, really. I mean I'm proof that you don't have to go to a writing school and you don't have to do it properly. You can just muddle along, and if you really want it, then you will get there, I suppose.
That, I think that's good advice.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much, Lucy, for being on the show, and best of luck with Sad Janet.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Took my